This whole past month, we've looked at a body of teachings from the early Buddhist system known as the Brahma Viharas, or the divine abidings, or dwelling places. And they are they describe a set of orientations of the heart based in friendliness, or kindness, metta, and then branching out into how the heart meets both suffering and joy. When this basic kindness meets the experience of suffering, it takes the flavor or the aspect of compassion. Right? Not a different energy, but an energy oriented toward care for suffering. And when that kindness or friendliness meets the experience of well-being, then it turns into appreciation or celebration called appreciative joy, mudita. And when that kindness or friendliness or love, loving kindness, through maturing or resting deeply in this spread of experience, able to contact both suffering and joy, and remain in its nature of love and friendliness, so without contracting into fear or anger, or including the feelings of fear and anger, then a new quality, the fourth of these qualities, begins to grow, equanimity, upekkha, that describes the heart able to rest at the center of any kind of experience without losing its center, without losing the sense of itself as a loving force. So in our meditation tonight, I talked about this quality of like the center of gravity, or your own physical midline, or Eliot's beautiful phrase, the still point at the center of the turning world, all as a way to talk, or that, and the eye of the hurricane on this week where Hurricane Harvey is devastating the Texas Gulf Coast, and amazing images of kindness coming out of that area. Always the glimmering amid a great natural disaster like that is, you know, people just show up in their amazing generosity and kindness. I'm sure many of you have seen photographs that are incredible coming out of Texas, and some terrible, of course. This morning, the one that stuck with me was in the Times, was a photo of a man in a wetsuit on a stand-up paddleboard in the middle of a suburban neighborhood with the water, you know, halfway up the trees and pillars, with a four-year-old boy just like crouched on the front of like the surfboard, and the man was just paddling along, bringing this child to safety. And I was like, I never got excited to see a stand-up paddleboard, but it's not my sport. But then I was like, this is great. Like, you know, I could just imagine, you know, him being like, you know, maybe it would be great to have like a big flat-bottomed, you know, motorboat to like rescue lots of people. But he's like, what I have is a wetsuit and a stand-up paddleboard, like, let's go. And he's just like paddling through the suburban neighborhood, you know, with like taking toddlers across the raging street river. So beautiful generosity showing up, and endless stories like this. And so we can send our prayers, of course, to everyone being afflicted. And the metaphor of the eye of the hurricane being this idea, at least, that there's a place, which is really a state of being or mind or heart, that pauses in the center of everything spinning and has a chance to regroup or see clearly. And equanimity is a quality of the heart that has some of that stillness. That amid the swinging, you could say, pendulum of sorrow and joy, there's a kind of unshakability that can develop as we learn to be with more and more. And in the trauma work, we'll talk about this as a kind of resilience, that what we want is not to sort of like, you know, never get triggered or activated or scared or angry, and never cling to anything positive, but just like become this sort of narrow bandwidth, just like, I'm fine. I'm fine. Like, that's just freeze, right? That's not well-being at all. What we want, actually, is that dynamic range to actually be like, you know, holy smokes, the river is full of water. What can I do? And not just kind of get overwhelmed and be like, ah, we're losing everything, but be like, I have a wetsuit. Like, let's go. And just do it, right? And this is this beautiful quality that we have and that we can cultivate. So we've looked at this set of four heart qualities. And then we talked about last time or the time before this quality of generosity that often gets mentioned in the context of the heart qualities. It's not one of the classic four Brahma-vihara. But my teacher, Eugene Cash, at one point said he thought it should be. He called it the fifth Brahma-vihara. And there maybe there's reasons why it's not. I proposed that there was something about it being kind of in some way internally oriented rather than externally. But I partly think it's not because these practices arose a little bit in a monastic context where generosity is, or gratitude is woven into the entire relationship between monastics and lay people. And maybe it didn't need to be one of these exact qualities to cultivate because it was embedded in the system in other ways. And I don't know that. But it's a guess. What we find is that many, many of us find that this quality of gratitude can be one of the most powerful and orienting heart qualities. And that especially, I think, as a healing for psychologies of scarcity and low self-worth and self-hatred and, you know, the kind of not enoughness or never enoughness, deep scarcity that is embedded in our whole social system. It's embedded in our relational system and models. It's embedded in our psychology in many ways. In whatever way you were taught, and I think it's, you know, pristinely different for each of us, how you were taught to, that you were never quite good enough, or that there was never quite enough resources or quite enough ease. And gratitude flips that on its head and it says, look what I have received, look what has been given to me. One of the beautiful things for me very much about gratitude is that there's a sense in this moment of recognition of what has been received, what has come in, that I didn't do something to earn it. I didn't buy it, you know. I bought the cherries at Whole Foods. I spent money on them, and I didn't walk out going, I'm so grateful for these cherries from Whole Foods that I bought, not because I'm not grateful for cherries. Like, every time I eat a cherry, I'm like, oh my God, cherries. And I'm so grateful that cherries exist. But I'm not grateful to Whole Foods for selling them to me.
You mean Amazon,
man? Amazon. Yeah, exactly. I hear they're going to lower the prices, which, you know, is something. So there's something in gratitude where it's not about something being in exchange. It's partly why I want this to continue to be a gift economy group. That gratitude says, this didn't have to come to me. But it did. It was given. And therefore, something can open in me that is not bound in the transactional, right? I don't have to sort of be the powerful one who managed to, you know, get this thing. It wasn't my strength or my goodness that got this to me. It was given. And when something is given, there's this whole different quality. There's an energy that's exchanged completely differently than if something is sold or stolen, certainly, or any other way of, or found even, right? Given is a particular quality. I like that in the ethical precepts, there's this guideline. The guideline against stealing is sometimes translated as not to take that which is not offered to me or given to me. And This is very much coming out of the monastic tradition where everything was given. But there's some sense that like, oh, right, even when I, you know, even when I find something kind of like abandoned on the street, and I'm like, oh, look, it's a street find, you know. Even when I really know that it was put out on the street in order to be found, that's different from it being like somebody saying, you know, as someone here this evening said, you know, I brought this book for you. And it feels different, right? I could find this book on the street, or I could find it on Amazon, but they would not feel the same, right? And it's like, oh, you brought this for me. And there's a and there's an intimacy in that exchange that is, I think, more profound than we think it is. I'm going to bring in this parallel concept, a concept that's not talked about much because it implies a kind of a particular metaphysics that we don't really do in Western Buddhism. But this is a concept that was very central in the early system and grew in centrality in Asian Buddhist systems. And this is a concept called merit. The Pali word is punya. And it's a little bit like an energetic or spiritual currency. And the idea is that when you do something wholesome, like something kind for someone, or you do some spiritual practice, like you meditate, or you make a gift, and it was originally, all of the references to it in the earliest texts are that it is the thing that is accrued by lay people who make gifts to monastics. So if you... this past weekend, we were with a community of monastics that my family loves and supports, a community of nuns, growing the Buddhist monastic tradition for women here in California, and a new nun was ordained, or as we say, a nun was born this past weekend. A beautiful practitioner, very strong practitioner, very devoted to the path, of course, in her perhaps early 60s, late 50s, I think, and her two grown children presented the robe cloth in this sort of formal gesture to their mother, who was taking on this kind of ascetic practice. And she did this beautiful ceremony, essentially piles of chanting with her hands over her head. And, you know, all the nuns gathered and all the monks gathered in this temple. It was beautiful. And so she's entering the life where everything is given to her. And, you know, the robes are given, and the bowl is given, and the food every single day has to be given. Part of the monastic structure in the Theravada is that no food can be stored overnight. And so, you know, you go out with your bowl, and you get food in the morning. You have to eat before noon. And then whatever's not eaten is given away or thrown away. And the monastics don't save any of it. And so if you don't make contact with another layperson the very next morning, every single day of your life, you don't eat, right? There's no going off into the forest to fend for yourself or live in a cave or eat wild roots or anything in the Theravada. The monastics are completely embedded in the community. You need lay people to offer you the food every single day. And they can't even leave it at the monastery and be like, eat a little bit of this every day for a week, I'll see you next Monday. Every single day, they have to do this minimal ritual of the monastic being there and the layperson being there, and the layperson would just touch the dish of food, meaning I offer it to you, and then the monastic can eat. Everything has to be offered. So then merit is this quality that arises when you offer, or when you do anything wholesome, when you practice, et cetera, et cetera. And this was an intimate part of the earliest system, right, the relationship between lay people and monastics. As it grew, as the system grew, it acquired a complex, almost like cosmic significance. When one particular detail was added to it, which is that you could acquire merit by doing some wholesome thing, and then you could give that merit away to someone else by wishing it. I could say, may the merit that I've generated by supporting this nun to be ordained, may that merit go to, you know, my friend who's battling cancer, or go to the hurricane victims in Houston, you know, for their benefit. And it's like some spiritual force is transferred to them. It's said by some scholars, actually, this is a footnote, historical footnote, that this exact doctrine is the way that Buddhism managed to insinuate itself into China. Because two things. One, this was how you could continue to do the Chinese practice of ancestor worship and still be Buddhist. Because you could say, may all the merit of my practice go to my great ancestors. And that works in the metaphysics. So that supports the practice of ancestor worship to continue. The second thing that enabled Buddhism in China was the doctrine that you could see the emperor as a representative of the Buddha, and then therefore continue to worship the emperor. You know, you make a couple of doctrinal changes, and suddenly the whole thing can flower there. So this is the concept, the transferability of merit. So you don't need to think too much about that. But it's still a part of Western Buddhism. It's part of what came over when Buddhism came here. And the place it most often shows up is at the end of a practice period or a sitting group or a retreat, or in the way that I'm bringing it in tonight, at the end of a period of practice here in the space. And it's called a dedication of merit. And this has become a ritual gesture, a tiny ceremony that one does anytime you've done anything that generates merit, like sit for half an hour or gather together to talk about teachings. You can say, may the merit of my actions go out to all beings or go to a specific place. And then as the tradition grew into what's called the Mahayana, the great vehicle in Buddhism, this took on greater and greater significance because, of course, you know, if it generates good merit, which is another way of saying good karma in a certain way, to do the wholesome practices of generosity or sitting, then how much more good merit would it generate to give it away? It's the ultimate generous action. Therefore, if you give it away, 10,000 times more merit accrues in you. So you can never give it, you can't give it away fast enough. You keep wishing it away, and more appears in your cosmic merit account. Do I want to go here? I'm going to go into radical emptiness for a moment.
Yeah, do it.
Radical emptiness. The great Indian sage Bodhidharma travels to China. Speaking of China, here's the loop in. To bring Buddhism to China. The myth says that he rides a single stalk of bamboo through the waves with his beard flapping in the wind. And the Chinese pictures of him, he was called, like, you know, like the bearded one, because not so many beards in China of that kind, thin beards. But he had this like big sort of like Indian beard. And he's always depicted with these huge bushy eyebrows and big bug eyes and a big beard, partly because... We'll get to that. We'll get to how he practiced. So Bodhidharma, in this sort of magical way, goes to China to bring the Dharma of the Buddha to China. He goes to the emperor. And aspects of Buddhism have already arrived. He's bringing kind of Zen or the subtle Mahayana teachings. And the emperor knows about this teaching of merit. And the emperor says, I'm a great patron of religion. I have built so many monasteries, and I've translated texts, and I support all these monastics. I give so much money to the religion. How much merit am I generating? And Bodhidharma says, none at all. Right? Which is a contradiction to the teaching. Right? The teaching is like, oh, you've accumulated so much merit. And Bodhidharma says, none. And the emperor's like, explain. And Bodhidharma's like, you wouldn't get it. He walks out. And then the myth says he goes to a cave in southern China and waits for someone who would understand the deep teaching to show up. And he sits facing a wall for 9 years without a break. This is the beginning, by the way. If you go to the San Francisco Zen Center or the Berkeley Zen Center, and they sit facing the wall, this is why. And they sit eyes open, facing the wall. So Bodhidharma sits facing the wall, and at a certain point he gets a little sleepy. And in order to forestall sleepiness, he, trigger warning for the children, tears off his eyelids, throws them out the mouth of the cave, and they land on the ground, and they sprout up as the tea plant, Camellia sinensis, right? Whose leaves are these thin things that look like, perhaps, torn off eyelids? Who knows? Who knows? But they will keep you awake. So Bodhidharma is depicted as having these huge bug eyes, big eyebrows, a huge beard. He's called the barbarian from the West. And he waits for 9 years until a seeker shows up at the mouth of the cave and says, you know, "Blessed sage, please teach me." And Bodhidharma's like, "Why?" You know, and the seeker says, "Please, I long for the way. I've searched everywhere for please show me the nature of my mind. I want to know the nature of my mind." It's a great Zen question. And Bodhidharma says, "Show me your mind, and I'll show you its true nature." And the seeker goes, and Bodhidharma goes, "Got it?" Another part of the story, trigger warning, is that this seeker, before I skipped a bit because it was graphic, but before this happens, I'll just tell you, the seeker shows up and Bodhidharma says, "Go away." And the seeker says, "No, I'm really passionate about the way." And Bodhidharma says, "Prove it." And so the seeker chops off his own arm and tosses it into the snow, you know, as an offering. And Bodhidharma's like, "Oh, okay, you mean it." And then this ensuing thing about, you know, "Show me your mind." And this is the beginning of Zen in China, or Chan. So then the teachings that come out of this tradition, this great Mahayana tradition, oriented toward emptiness, they say, this is from the Diamond Sutra now, it says the bodhisattva who does the deepest practice possible, this profound practice, accumulates merit as great as, you know, thousands of world systems. But even though he accumulates, you know, does all that practice, it accumulates that merit so great, how much merit has he really accumulated? None at all. And there's this way that the teaching of emptiness, like, undercuts the whole thing. Everything dissolves into nothingness. And the beautiful translator Red Pine makes a very nice kind of slippery pathway through this. And because the text literally says, the bodhisattva acquires a body of merit as great as the such and such and such. Which, of course, is a way of translating acquires an amount of merit or a mass of merit. And then Red Pine says, "Oh, no, the seeker acquires a body," like takes the word literally, and the body becomes the body of merit. Your body itself becomes the body of merit when you undertake practice. And of course, that is seen ultimately as empty, empty of separateness, empty of a small, divided loneliness. When you realize that what you think you are is everything, or is absolutely inseparable from everything. Right? The concept of merit rests on a dualism. You do something wholesome, merit comes to you, you can give that away to others. We're still resting in the reality of self and other, which is appropriate. And then at a deeper level of practice, that drops away. There's no giving and taking of merit, right? Merit dissolves when you see that everything is already. Whatever word you put here, perfect, complete, of the suchness would be a Zen way to put it. So that was a kind of looping, set aside the deep emptiness part. If you're confused, don't worry about it. Come back, we'll talk about emptiness some more. But what I want to do, actually, is chant the dedication of merit. this ritual that says that this profound exchange is possible, and really feeling the way that generosity is one side of this equation, right? Generosity and gratitude are linked. Generosity is one side, gratitude is the other side. And of course, they're inseparable, right? There can be no gratitude unless something was generously given. And there can be no generosity unless there's a potential recipient. And so then merit arises as a result of that intimate exchange and is given away as a gesture of intimacy with all things. So I'll chant the Theravada version of what's known as the dedication of merit, often done at the end of practice periods. We'll do it as an honoring of the of many years of this group meeting here, and as a blessing for all those who practice in this space. As you hear the words, you can, again, sit in meditation or just let them resonate in you in whatever way they point you toward your own generosity of spirit. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent, and hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing, may all defilements and attachments quickly cease and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana. In every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind, with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble guide. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled. And the traditional response to this, if you want to say it, is sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Sadhu, 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 sadhu. That means well said, well said. So... thank you. I like that there's still this thread, and again, it feels like an ancient thread in the tradition to say, you know, here we are doing this thing. We often talk about it in relation to like our psychology, trauma, the social systems, this very kind of like, what are we doing here and now conversation. And then we get a chant like this that says, you know, like, may the celestial beings, the guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death be blessed by my practice. And I chant that and I'm like, I'm just going to chant it. Like, may it be so. I don't know who these beings are, really. But it feels right to say it. So, gratitude for our time here and for our practice and for the blessing of community. Such a pleasure to be here with everybody. May the merit of our practice in this space radiate out in all directions to bless all beings and keep all beings safe from suffering. So, yeah. Let me just take a few minutes for any thoughts and reflections, responses. Yeah.
There was a teaching or sitting or whatever basically duality and non-duality. It was the first time I remember hearing it said in a certain way. And today that was really striking. Like, I was feeling very much the connection, basically, of everything. Like, the non-dual nature, basically? Is that the right way to phrase that?
I like how you're phrasing it. Go on.
And there is sometimes specific triggers that will make me like slip into that place that is easy to get to in this room for me. But the thing today was this beautiful song that I highly recommend that's new called Little Speck, referring to the planet and the connection by Josh Geld. And the lyrics are beautiful. And I was walking to Bart after this intense, busy day again at work. We just have these nonstop days at the animal shelter. And every single person I saw on the mission on the way to 16th Street, Bart, I feel connected with them. Like, I'm not different from them. Like, we don't have the same exact experiences, but we have the same general feelings. And it was beautiful. And it wasn't just people, like the seagull flying over, and just the sweetness and delicacy, delicate nature of the world. It was just so touching. So it's nice to have that mirrored back in your teaching and then to learn here.
Okay. Yeah. That feeling. Other thoughts? Yes.
I've been wanting to ask a question that's not really related to your teachings, and since this seems like a little bit of a free-for-all tonight.
There's truffles after all, or there were. You're stepping out. Yeah.
So I teach yoga, and I've been having some debate in my mind about how much to bring in Buddhist philosophy to those classes. I have some teachers who like really spend the whole time talking Dharma while we're doing yoga, and I love that. And then I have some teachers that really assert that it is not the best for most people to try to mix in heady philosophy with just the physical work.
Yeah.
And I believe both of those to be somewhat true. So right. I did in my classes, and I'm like, how much do I want to share? Like, I've been reading the Dhammapada, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I need to share this, and yet I like resist doing that to some extent because I don't want to blow. I want to like make the class approachable.
Yeah.
And I wonder what your thoughts on that were.
I think it sounds great what you're doing because you're asking the question, you know. I think that both of those models have some wisdom to them, you know. Some people are going to really like a class where you're like, you know, lift your foot and step into warrior, you know, and remember that Arjuna was taught by Krishna to act without thought of result, and, you know, like, or, like, some people are going to be like, that's totally my jam. And other people, you know, are going to be like, you know, actually, can you just play some music and, like, I can just, like, inhale and exhale and, like, find myself. And it's just different folks, right? The main thing that I tried to do was not so much to teach philosophy, but to let the practices behind the philosophies be present in my teaching. So, like, rather than teaching that, you know, rather than teaching a term, like, you know, equanimity is the state where pleasant and unpleasant arise and pass without fixation, like, that's a philosophy, I would teach in a way where I'm like, you know, as you rest into the pose and you're engaging with sensation, like, see if, like, do you like it? Do you dislike it? Like, what's happening on the energetic level in relation to pleasant and unpleasant? And what happens if you, you know, soften a little toward either one? And I'll make it a physical instruction, you know? Mm-hmm. But it's embedded in this wisdom teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of us, you know, in the yoga world do that in different ways. I'm sure you do in your own way, of course. Mm-hmm. Because those guidelines are where the physical practice came from, you know? Krishnamacharya was orienting toward Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, and it says balance ease with stability. And so we teach that a lot, right? Not to be in the extremes of effort or... So I've been in classes that do both. I don't have a big idea that one of them is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because to me it was like an ethical question. Like, is there... But it sounds like you're saying you don't think that there's necessarily a right or a wrong there.
From a Buddhist philosophical or doctrinal standpoint, the ethics of it would be, or like the karmic force of it would be based in your intention.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if you were trying to convince people that a certain view was the right view,
mm-hmm.
then that's one maneuver.
Mm-hmm.
That's, again, not necessarily wrong. Buddhism is an evangelical religion.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also not necessarily what you want to do. And, you know, it's different if you're saying, you know, coming from some other intention.
Mm-hmm.
The main thing I wanted with my students was not to confuse them.
Mm-hmm.
So not to be too abstract, and also not to be too much of a collage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like to say, here's deep equanimity and renunciation in the first half of class, and in the second half I'm going to read a Rumi poem about, you know, breaking the wine glass and falling backward into the glassblower's breath. That's a different class. And I'm kind of just going to, like, teach those as different classes. I'm going to be like, today we're doing the glassblower's breath class, and that's the only poem I'm going to read, and we're going to orient toward divinity and drunkenness and breath and falling upward into the source of the heat, whatever you say. And in a different class, I'm going to be like, notice pleasure and let it go. Notice discomfort and let it go. What happens if you let everything go? And those are just different classes. So at least I want it to make sense to people.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So I think it's a great investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Yeah. Yeah, Peter.
I'm struck by this, this generosity and this sort of gratitude almost arising the practice of generosity.
Mm-hmm.
And then I start thinking that generosity in a way is like surrender, I'm giving.
Yeah.
But it's also like grief. I'm letting go, losing,
yeah.
giving
yeah.
it up.
Yeah.
And this sort of, I'm just seeing this parallel with grief and joy. So mm-hmm. when you mm-hmm. go through your grief, this joy arises.
Yeah.
When you go generously offer, you let go of the thing,
yeah.
gratitude arises.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
does that make sense?
It's beautiful. Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's like the same thing. So
I like particularly the thing that you're saying about grief as a kind of giving. Right?
Mm.
That because of course grief is not an unwholesome contraction, right? It's one of the wholesome emotions. And it's wholesome, I think, because it's connected to real relationship. So you're saying in a way, this is important to me, or I am in intimacy with this thing. I've given myself to it. The grief is a way of saying, here is one more offering
mm.
to this that's been so good, you know.
Which is also surrender.
It is. It absolutely
is.
It's
also meditation, which is like letting go, letting go.
Yeah, if I, you know, it, so much of it doesn't work if I'm kind of, you know, if I'm sort of batten down the hatches because there's, you know, there's only a certain amount of love to go around and I gotta hold on, right? That's a different body, we would say. That's a different body of merit than one that is freely opening, you know, or learning or practicing to open and give. Yeah, it's beautiful. Thank you. Anything else before we close tonight?
Just as you guys were talking about this, it reminded me of something you brought earlier about the sort of the infinite multiplication of merit.
Yeah.
And but the, yeah. There's a practical experience maybe most of us have had it, all of us. The more you give, the more you realize you have, which is an amazing thing. And I think it's sort of just so much how when we don't feel like we have and we don't give, our resources feel so limited. But as we give, say, kindness or something, we realize we don't have any less of it than when we started giving. In fact, we have more of it.
Yes.
And so I think that that's a really the practical side of that.
It is. And like in a lot of religions, you know, the Buddhist tradition has its share of, you know, stories of someone, you know, giving material resources in an absolute kind of way, you know, and then all sorts of good fortune coming back to them. Particularly in relation to, you know, this, the sense of the heart practices of kindness and love, you know, and compassion. Maybe particularly compassion. There can often be this feeling that, like, there's so much suffering out there that if I start to care about every little bit, I'll kind of run dry in a certain way. And I think this is a problem with empathy, but not a problem with compassion. Compassion is what happens when I see and I care, but the uplift is internal to my, like, there's it's love in myself. Empathy is like, I have to feel what the other being is feeling, and that's exhausting. I can't actually feel everyone else's suffering, but I can care in a universal kind of way. I can care more and more. And caring nourishes. So the more you care, the more you're able to care. And that's the model for compassion. So there is the sense that it's this kind of inexhaustible quality. And this becomes a meditative quality. All of the heart qualities can be the meditative focus for the deep states known as jhana or dhyana, where the mind can get extremely focused with this feeling and enter some of the most boundless states that are available in the system. And then, of course, these become some of the most popular methods for entering these phenomenally boundless states. Like if you're going to enter a kind of cosmic mind state, you know, you could do it by concentrating on the breath or the color blue or something, but you could also just do it by contacting the feeling of, like, loving everything and then spread that out to be as big as the universe. It turns out to be very nice. Like, it's not only a boundless mind state, but it's saturated with the feeling of love. And there's kind of not much better than that in the realm of, you know, dwellings for the heart. So, thank you everyone again. We will meet next week at Namaste Berkeley. It'll be our new vihara, our new dwelling place. Part of the agreement that enabled us even to continue this group for the last 2 weeks was that I signed a volunteer agreement. In other words, they had to immediately stop what we were doing 3 weeks ago. So last week and this week are free, and my gift to you all. You know, if you must give something, you can give later, like next week or any time or online, yada, yada. But really, nothing here tonight, and but take some snacks home. Yeah?
We could give out your website. There's a little link if we want.
You can dig around on the website and find it. It's a little bit buried. I'm that kind of marketing person. It's very difficult to give me money, but you can figure it out if you want to. Or you can just come to satsang more and you'll have lots of opportunities. So blessings to everyone. Welcome to new folks. You lucked out and you came on snack night. Take some snacks home and we'll see you next week, 7:30 rather than 7:45. Yeah? Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.